Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 79 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 878. Okay, and recall that they were beginning to unpack the details of what became of the descendants of the Adamites. Most specifically, what are called the Andites, those individuals that have just a little bit of blending of evolutionary blood in with the Adamic stock. And initially, that's coming from the Adamites mating with the Noddites, in most cases quite close at hand to the second garden. So that's the first part of their story that we just finished, is basically what's happening in Mesopotamia as the millennia roll on, starting about 35,000 BC, in Mesopotamia and the immediate environs. They were talking about, as they were going through that, they were saying, okay, and then there was these Andites that went in this big wave this way and that way. And they touched upon what was going on in the bigger context, but they didn't get into any details. Well, now they're going to go into the details. And they're going to start with those who went east. So, in a generalized sense, the Orient. Those who headed towards the east, and it's going to start out close to home and move further away in an obvious logical fashion. And so one of the very first things that they want to address is a little bit more about Turkestan that we've touched upon, as I said, a few times here as they've been slowly kind of spinning up this story. And immediately, we touch upon some archaeological evidence that especially got popularized not that many years ago, just in recent decades. It's very, very intriguing for this whole issue of these peoples prior to recorded history. They're called the Andites. These peoples that are not as pure as Adamites, but are definitely genetically a cut above any of us today. Those on the planet today with the most Adamic blood is minuscule compared to the significant fraction that the Andites had. And to just remember, don't judge them just because, say, they're back in the Neolithic or even further back in the Paleolithic or something, just because they aren't using titanium tools, they're using stone tools. Don't think that they don't have a mind with a lot of potential, and that potential is being seeded all over the world, eventually, when technology is of a higher degree is discovered, the potential of that Adamic, blood through the Andites is up to the task of actualizing to match that technology, and having more sophisticated culture. Okay, so let's get into a little bit here. Let's see what they do in this little one-paragraph preface here to set the stage for the Orient here.
Paper 79. Andite expansion in the Orient. Asia is the homeland of the human race. It was on a southern peninsula of this continent that Andon and Fanta were born. In the highlands of what is now Afghanistan, their descendant, Baronan, founded a primitive center of culture that persisted for over 500,000 years. Here at this eastern focus of the human race, the Sangic peoples differentiated from the Andonic stock. And Asia was their first home, their first hunting ground, their first battlefield. Southwestern Asia witnessed the successive civilizations of Dalmatians, Nodites, Adamites, and Andites. And from these regions, the potentials of modern civilization spread to the world.
Okay, so even though this was being written way back there in the beginning of the 20th century, they knew full well, in this case it's an archangel writing this paper, the authors all knew full well where the sort of the ignorance of human assumptions would take us scientifically. So basically what you see they're doing with this singular opening paragraph is saying, no, not in any way, shape, or form is mankind out of Africa. All right, mankind is out of Asia. Now, see, that's what obviously is going. So not just biologically, but culturally as well. The last part is stressing that. Like I said, in every way, shape, and form, the actual story of humankind is all founded in Asia, in one place or another. So that's the key thing. So you just think about, it doesn't matter where you turn in human thinking these days. It's not just archaeologically, but anthropologically and what have you. Everyone rationalizes all the data they collect, knowing that mankind came out of Africa not that long ago, supposedly, and all sorts of magical things happened to mankind to get the diversity that we see today. Okay. Literally things as foolish as, as you walk north, your skin color lightens. They literally believe stuff like this. So it's like I was saying at the beginning, you think about this, supposedly this is this high genetic person, this Andite, and but they're mucking around with stone tools. Isn't that a primitive person? Okay, who's the more primitive? Someone who uses a stone tool or someone who thinks that as you walk, into higher latitudes, your skin lightens? Seriously. Like I said, there's primitive, and then which is natural, and then there's the unnatural thing that has led to the emergency. Why this book is in my lap? This pre-primitive thinking that goes in the name of modern today. No primitive person ever believed something as silly as I think that if I migrate northward, my skin is going to lighten. One needs to be humble about where we are these days. Okay, anyway, back to this main story. So, let me just touch upon, remember, we've gone through a lot of this in detail already, but they're just highlighting it. Remember that we've got the first two will creatures on this world, Andon and Fanta, about 1,000,000 years ago. And notice what they say there. That was 1,000,000 years ago, so geography has changed a lot in the last 1,000,000 years. So they don't say something like the southern peninsula, right, of Asia. It's a southern peninsula. In other words, a peninsula is not even there anymore. Right? Notice the wording there. It was on a southern peninsula. That's all been washed away and stuff now. But they went northward, and so as you move away from the coasts, it's more likely that land is still going to be there today, and it is. We still have a region. They say what's now called Afghanistan, and those highland regions there.
Which got to be pretty high. Afghanistan.
Right, right. So, you know, yeah, I mean, things have gone up in the last million years, you know, as the Indian subcontinent is slamming in. We'll get to some of the earthquake stuff here in a little bit because of all that. But nonetheless, you know, there were highlands back then. And you had, remember, you had that that group that finally recognized that if they didn't get very aggressive, they were all going to get sucked by back mating, you know, into a subhuman state again. Because you had all these near human individuals that are biologically compatible, but not, you know, all didn't have all seven adjutants, weren't full human mind. And there was all this back mating going on, and it was dragging everything down. And so, you know, they just cleared the the territory as far as the eye could see in every direction of all this inferior stock, and founded what is properly thought of as Neanderthal, but not what current scientists call Neanderthal, remember, which is Neanderthal upstepped by Blue Man is what current scientists call Neanderthal, and that was a lot later on. You know, but this is back, you know, for those who don't remember, if you turn, you know, you can, paper 64, section 3, if you want to, you know, go back and read that again, where they're talking about this. 850,000 years ago, you had this core of still relatively integrous andonic stock that established themselves there and spread over the globe. And notice what they're giving you, that little detail there. That's why I reminded you that that was 850,000 years ago, because they said that they founded this center of primitive culture that persisted for over 500,000 years. So, you know, they want to give us that context so that all the way up to, you know, a little past 350,000 years ago, you had still in that same location the relatively pure andonic peoples. Okay. They, the ones that hadn't gone places and backmated and whatnot, again. So you still had that core group. And so when we've been talking, you know, in recent times about, you know, Andonites being involved in issues, you know, recognize it's not that far away that you have this center of the relatively pure Andonites. And they don't start to get pushed from that location until about 350,000 years ago. It's like, well, why did they, you know, 500,000 years, and then finally, what happened? Well, remember, 500,000 years ago, the Sangiks come into existence, and the Sangiks push them out of that space. The Andonites get pushed, you know, to the margins. They get pushed to the higher regions, to the higher latitudes, and the Sangiks take over the better geographic locations. So, you know, once you get the Sangiks building up into significant numbers and wanting to have their own space, right, that's when finally the Andonites lose their original location there. But it was 150,000 years later still. So so everyone was kind of living together for a long time. All right, and then you know, then they give you that whole bit about, you know, their first home, their first hunting ground, their first battlefield. You know, and then in comes what you have from the first and second epical revelations, the first and second engagements by those from above, in first in Dalmatian and then with Adam and Eve, that produce, you know, yes, it's in the Near East, but it still is in Asia. What gives mankind the potential for civilization? Because even the best of the primary Sangiks don't have innately the kind of a mind that can take on much in the way of civilization. Society, yes, culture, yes, but something worthy of not just being called semi-civilized, but civilized, that requires biologic uplift. That's why Adam and Eve come. And so, as you see there, you know, and where it really gets migrating is with the Andites, as they say there. And that's the story we're reading. So they're just reminding you that it's, you know, isn't it interesting that despite the fact that, you know, saying that the Neanderthals went all over Asia and Africa and, you know, Europe and whatnot, I mean, everything is pretty tightly located. Right, the planetary headquarters is set up not too far away from where Annan Fanta and Madonnan and all, you know, where it all, it's all kept pretty tight for a long time. And it's only, see, once you finally get the Andites, and especially the very tail end of the Andites, when there's horses, that finally changes. That mankind really pushes in a significant way beyond just kind of mingling around in the homeland area. You know, and partly because the prince and his staff and Adam and Eve kind of kept it close to home by where they, you know, where they locate. You know, they could have located themselves in North America. That would have totally, you know, mixed things up, but they didn't. They kept it very close to home there. Okay, so that's, you know, so besides it's not out of Africa, they're wanting to kind of just think through all that, as I just unpacked for you. That's what we're really studying in a bigger sense, is mankind finally, you know, just like a little child, initially, you know, they're holding onto their mom's leg, and they'll journey a few steps away, and then they scurry back, right? And hold on again. You know, this is kind of mankind getting to 16 and older. And you know, I don't need to hang around home anymore. I can just go somewhere. And so that's kind of the story we're telling, is mankind finally maturing to the point where they feel bold enough to really head for the horizons in a significant way.
And then when they get to be 23 or 24,
they come
back
home.
Typeface a little bit different on Dalmatian, Nonites, and Adamites?
No.
Anyway.
Yeah, okay.
Mine is.
Oh, that's weird. Okay. Maybe it's a...
Well, because when Gene usually finds mistakes in his... yours and mine, you're always using the same one. He was reading something else, and so I was just wondering.
It might have just, is it kerned a little differently, maybe?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Okay, anyway. Typographic issues aside, what about Turkestan here?
Section 1. The Andites of Turkestan. For over 25,000 years, on down to nearly 2000 B.C., the heart of Eurasia was predominantly, though diminishingly, Andite. In the lowlands of Turkestan, the Andites made the westward turning around the inland lakes into Europe, while from the highlands of this region, they infiltrated eastward. Eastern Turkestan, Sinkiang, and to a lesser extent Tibet, were the ancient gateways through which these peoples of Mesopotamia penetrated the mountains to the northern lands of the Yellowmen. The Andite infiltration of India proceeded from the Turkestan highlands into the Punjab and from the Iranian grazing lands through Baluchistan. These earlier migrations were in no sense conquests. They were, rather, the continual drifting of the Andite tribes into Western India and China.
Okay. So they start with a little synopsis, which you can tell that... we're finally going to talk a little bit more about Sinkiang, like they've been hinting at for a while here. But let's think about what else they say here. So again, they're reminding us that we're telling a story that, on the one hand, sort of ends at around 6,000 BC when recorded history begins, and so, you know, they don't need to tell a lot of that story because we have a lot of it. They need to clean up some details for us, but we keep seeing 2,000 BC because, as we talked about last time, I think it was those 4,000 years from 6,000 to 2,000 BC. You have the kind of the final passing of the torch, as it were, many things kind of get into the state that you're sort of aware of, even if you aren't an expert in ancient history. Kind of the basic state of the world as you can, you know, experience it today, or you can kind of easily extrapolate from what you can experience today. In the last 4,000 years, have a lot of record to them and a lot of awareness to them. Like we mentioned in Mesopotamia, all the Andite stuff, you know, even the tail on Sumerian stuff is all gone, you know, basically 2000 BC. And you have the Babylonians now, you know, at 2000 BC. You know, you're about to switch gears and have Machiavelli Melchizedek show up in 1980 BC. Just a number of things in terms of a lot of the really major climate change that painted the globe kind of as it is today, with where there are deserts and where there aren't, you know, that kind of was fully in place by 2000 BC. So in a number of ways, that you know, that's a benchmark time. Okay, so that's why they keep referring it to it. So you're coming all the way down to that. They want to, and that'll be immediately apparent, that 2000 BC thing, when we get to the next paragraph, for instance, with climate change. Okay, let's see. And then, you know, obviously we'll eventually get to the story as they go to Europe, like they're talking about there, around the Caspian Sea and over into Europe. But we basically want to tell them going east right now. And, you know, so remember again, Turkestan is sort of that whole general region that's now occupied by lots of countries that end in Stan. Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, etc. You know, you name it. But that in general, that's all Turkestan. But don't forget, Turkestan in that general sense includes what's now Western China. You know, which even back at the writing here wasn't part of China. Xinjiang, the northwestern part of present China, the country of China, and Tibet. Of course, I think most people know that there's a lot of tension in Tibet about being absorbed into China, because that happened not that long ago. Tibet in the southwestern and Xinjiang in the northwestern, that's especially Xinjiang is, you know, you can think of as part of Turkestan. So those kind of peoples, as we've read, a lot of immediate Andite settling and upstepping and interest there, okay, because of Adamson, you know, kind of seeding that up there by the Caspian Sea. All right, and. Okay, and so then, you know, they're going to head, you know, eventually they're going to penetrate farther eastward. But they're already meeting Yellow Man, remember we read that, you know, in Xinjiang. Because initially Yellow Man doesn't go all the way to the east, he's just going there. And Andites are meeting Yellow Man there. And then Yellow Man goes further to the east and gets met again as the Andites engage them further to the east. And then obviously we're going to have a big story about India. And notice that they're pointing out what we saw hints of last session. And they talking about those last waves from 8,000 to 6,000 BC, which were basically on horseback as the Andites are going places. Remember how they said you had ones that that headed east, a fraction of them headed kind of straight east into what's now Iran. Besides the one that they're going up towards Turkestan, and from both ways, so you see they're both kind of coming, from Turkestan going southeast into India, so going through the Punjab, like they're saying there, and into northern India, or going the southern route, going through Baluchistan, in other words, what we have today, going through what's now southern Pakistan and southeastern Iran, going that way into India.
Because Pakistan used to be India.
Right, and of course, at the time of the writing, as I keep reminding you, there wasn't a Pakistan, remember, and there wasn't a Bangladesh either. I mean, it was all India, at the time of this writing. Okay, and you didn't have the contested Punjab and all that stuff, right? at least not like you do today. So they're just, they're just pointing out that they're going to be coming in through both that kind of more northern route and then a more southern route into India there. Okay, so that's the stage. They've got the basic geography all set there for us. So then they want to give us a few tidbits, and immediately, see, they're giving you things like where you should be going, oh, that's what that's about, right? Because that's what we're looking for. All of those mysteries that we've come upon, as I've said many times, almost always the answer to the mystery is Andite. It's not some fanciful notion that humans have dreamt up. It's Andites. The Andites are the reason that you've got something very strange that you find in some area, whether it's architectural stuff or human remains or whatever it might be. If it's very mysterious, most likely the answer is that's the Andites. That's that pre-history people that set the stage that we currently think sort of somehow magically set itself. And there was no one that said it. So what do they have here? What about, especially, let's focus on Sin Kiang.
For almost 15,000 years, centers of mixed Andite culture persisted in the basin of the Tarim River in Sin Kiang and to the south in the highland regions of Tibet, where the Andites and Andonites had extensively mingled. The Tarim Valley was the easternmost outpost of the true Andite culture. Here they built their settlements and entered into trade relations with the progressive Chinese to the east and with the Andonites to the north. In those days, the Tarim region was a fertile land. The rainfall was plentiful. To the east, the Gobi was an open grassland where the herders were gradually turning to agriculture. This civilization perished when the rain winds shifted to the southeast. But in its day, it rivaled Mesopotamia itself.
Okay, so, maybe you can start in lots of places. How about if I just, point out the climatic change issues that they're bringing up in the latter part there? When you go to Sin Kiang today, besides the mountains in the north and the mountains in the south, you see a vast desert, the Taklamakan Desert. Right? Back in the day, it was a fertile land, and rainfall was plentiful. And so, you can just imagine that big, huge space there. That's, desert now is a big, wonderful little region with, beautiful mountains to the north and the south. Okay? And you go to the east, it wasn't the Gobi Desert. All right? You didn't have the Taklamakan Desert and the Gobi Desert, right? You had grassland in what's now the Gobi Desert. Sort of the last gasp when people are trying to hold on there is like about 2000 BC. And then it's just getting way too arid. So like I said, see, that's again why 2000 BC is an important date. You can see it finally settling in very much like we find it today around that time. Certainly from 2000 to 1000 BC, anyone that's holding on in some of these regions is holding on by their fingernails. Okay. This is getting very, very difficult to live there. Right. Yeah, they don't have center pivots. You wouldn't find a big circle of green somewhere there, you know, like you might find today. So there's that basic climate issue. As we've seen so many times, you know, anyone who thinks there might be big climate change doesn't know history. Think about what these Andites in Sinkiang would think of us. You know, relative to climate change. Like, dude, you don't know what climate change is. Anyway, back to the main story. Notice it's you know, in Tibet, you know, you know, a lot of people know, you know, even the Nazis, you know, were picking up on, you know, there's something about Tibet, you know, and they're running around with their calipers, you know, looking for long heads and looking for blue eyes it's like, well, there's something about Tibet. But see, now in Tibet, you know, you have a lot of Andonites, as you know, a lot of times they're driven to higher elevations, like we were saying. So the Andonites and the Andites mixed extensively there, see, as they say. But in terms of a very relatively pure Andite civilization for thousands of years, it's right there in what now appears to be a basically uninhabitable desert in Sinkiang. Just like I was saying, the yellow man is eventually getting, you know, all the way to the east, but there's this extensive trade engagement with them to the east. And also with the Andonites that have been driven to higher latitudes that are in the north. Okay. Eventually they're kind of pushed all the way up to the northern margins of Siberia and Scandinavia and whatnot, right? We'll that whole bit about the trade thing, we'll pick up the rest of that story here in just a little bit. Tip my hand yet on that one. Let's go back to, the Tarim Basin, the Tarim River Basin. You know, these days, you know, all this water's flowing out of the mountains and it all just evaporates, you know, into nothing, you know, out in the desert eventually. But, you definitely still have a river there. It's not what it was back in the day. And this easternmost outpost of true Andite culture, just the fact that they say true Andite culture, you know, say instead of genuine, say, they're reminding you of this higher quality genetics that they just have. So even if they have relatively primitive technology compared to us, they have a mind that has a much more natural, holistic synchronization with the cosmos. Their culture might have been limited, but it was more well-rounded, one might say. And then ours, we can get very fixated, you know, and we lose the holistic quality of it. Yeah, because very specialized and very narrowly channeled, you know. So you're going, all right, if this is the case, that for thousands and thousands of years, there was this very significant, rivaling Mesopotamia itself, Andite civilization in Sinkiang there, and climate didn't really bring this to an end until, you know, say 2000 BC or thereabouts. I mean, I should be able to find something of this, shouldn't I? That's not that long ago, if they're that significant. You know, so you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, when you had some guys that started to dig around in there looking for signs of, you know, what they knew there was older civilization in the Turkestan region, and they're kind of digging for details. They found something very curious. Because, okay, so you have, when it's all wet and everything, and all these Andites are dying, you know, if they're not, you know, if they're not doing cremation or anything like that, you know, their bodies immediately decay, and there's nothing to be found. But what about these people who are right there, and things are getting very, very dry, and they get buried, so that they're naturally mummified? If you have the correct kind of soil that will foster that natural mummification, it's extremely dry. Yes, that's exactly what happened. All right, and they're digging around, they dig up these graves, and they go, what in the world is this? This looks like a Northern European in Sin Kang. All right, the very famous Tarim mummies. That all of the scientists, you know, still scratch their heads about. You know, if you're a sons of the Han of Han supremacist, you like to kind of ignore the existence even of the Tarim mummies. But even, you know, Western scientists, you know, they don't know what to make of this. They just, you know, they're grasping for some rationalization scheme. I mean, the only thing that makes it so they can feel like they can quasi-rationalize it is that, oh, it's like, well, they aren't very ancient. So I guess I can imagine that some small number came there as traders or something, you know, not that long ago. You know, they have no idea that for thousands and thousands of years, right, before 2000 BC, those people were there. And that would be very difficult for them to rationalize. But you dig up these people and you find this very sophisticated weaving technology and all sorts of stuff like this, right? You find Andites. Those aren't mummified Caucasoids from Northern Europe or something, right? No, those are Andites. They're not white man at all. Those are Andites, mummified. You know, and you know, there's just wonderful things. I mean, I won't go into the details. You know, if you've never looked up stuff about the Tarim mummies, look it up. It's very fascinating.
The ones that were like sand and sodium or something like that.
Right. I mean, you got this natural stuff. You know, but you know, they're very well preserved. You know, their clothing, you know, and their skin and everything, still very well preserved. You know, so you can see their tribal tattoos still. You know, just like the whole Cain story, like we've read, you know, if you didn't have the correct tattoo, you know, you'd be executed. You know, so you see that in all the fancy weaving technology, you know, that the Andites had. You know, you see this clear signs of a very sophisticated mentality. You know, color, you know, beautiful color, dyed, you know, fabrics and all sorts of cool stuff. So that, you know, as you're reading this, you're going, oh, that's what the Tarim mummies are. They're Andites. And you'll see they even mention it as, obviously, as things are petering out there, the remaining Andites are finally going to mate with more, you know, like Mongolian peoples, and they're just going to blend in, you know, and you actually see that there, you know, you'll see, okay, there's Mongolian-like peoples buried with the Andites, and then eventually, you know, they're all just genetically melt in. You know, those that didn't die off, you know, like, you know, Rada was just going to die off rather than procreate, because she didn't want to mate, you know, she didn't want to mate with an evolutionary stock. She wanted to mate with a pure nonite, and there weren't any to mate with, right? There's that mentality. They would have stayed, you know, only mating amongst themselves for thousands of years, but eventually, right, it all fades into the evolutionary background. Okay, so, like I said, we'll get to this trade relations thing, you know, the consequences of that. In a little bit here. Let's see, everything else there? Yeah, I think we got everything. Anyone else have any other questions they're confused with about that? Oh, T-A-R-I-M. All right. Okay, so now you can see, we start up the next paragraph here. We got a familiar date again cropping up. What do they say here?
By 8000 BC, the slowly increasing aridity of the highland regions of Central Asia began to drive the Andites to the river bottoms and the seashores. This increasing drought not only drove them to the valleys of the Nile, Euphrates, Indus, and Yellow Rivers, but it produced a new development in Andite civilization. A new class of men, the traders, began to appear in large numbers.
Okay, so touching back again on that that date we've seen before of 8000 BC, and in other words, the beginning of the Neolithic, okay, and that, as I pointed out, from 8000 to 6000 BC, that's when the very major climate change was being established. And as they're pointing out, that's what's going to drive those last waves of Andites in various ways, as everyone reshuffles where they are to find happy hunting grounds, as it were. And everyone knows that as we get into recorded history, you have this fixation with the big rivers, the Indus, the Yellow, right, the Nile, of course, Mesopotamia, Tigris and Euphrates. See, they're explaining why that is. Why is it that when when we dig up our oldest civilization evidence, we find it by these big rivers? It's not totally as you would think. That it's like, well, that's the easiest place for people to live, and so that's the only place they've ever lived. No, that's where they kind of were forced to live. These were Andites. They had a lot of sophisticated quality to their mind. They could live in lots of places. They weren't people looking for a salubrious climb and just laying on their back and waiting for the dates to fall in their mouth. Okay, they were living all over, but it just got to be so difficult to live in a lot of places that they were driven there, and so that's why as recorded history begins. Yeah, except for the Mesopotamia, you end up with the Nile and the Yellow and the Indus, etc., being these fixation points. Okay, let's see. And they're here you see the trader issue again. They're gonna explain that a little bit more in a second here. They're obviously building up to something. They repeated that. Okay, so. So that's again, there. You can see we're rehashing some of the things that we've already talked about, but they're throwing in specific things that they haven't mentioned before to help us appreciate exactly how civilization got in place in the Orient. All right.
When climatic conditions made hunting unprofitable for the migrating Andites, they did not follow the evolutionary course of the older races by becoming herders. Commerce and urban life made their appearance. From Egypt through Mesopotamia and Turkestan to the rivers of China and India, the more highly civilized tribes began to assemble in cities devoted to manufacture and trade. Adonia became the Central Asian commercial metropolis, being located near the present city of Ashgabat. Commerce in stone, metal, wood, and pottery was accelerated on both land and water.
Okay. So, reflect on this. Why are they telling you this? What What's the key thing? I mean, I've already been saying it many times, actually. Look what they're saying. We talked about the evolution of civilization, the natural thing that they're talking about. You go from a gatherer to a hunter to a herder to a farmer. That's the natural process. But you've got Andites that have naturally have a high enough mind where they naturally do unnatural things, if you will, right? The unnaturalness is more in their nature, right? And so they do a very unnatural thing, something that involves choice more than just, chugging along and kind of doing what your instincts, motivate you to do, quote unquote motivate you, right? Just sort of drive you to do. And actually bring in genuine motivation, genuine spiritual motive, free will chosen. No, let's do something unnatural. Let's build cities and establish commerce. Right, let's establish civilization. Right, as we start to think of it, when you actually start having things like that, it's like, well, I don't know, shouldn't I give a little bit higher quality name to that than just barbarian? I mean, they've got cities and commerce and stuff. Yeah, see, that's that going beyond the fifth and sixth adjutants and starting to bring in the seventh adjutant and your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, right? And doing things that are distinctly unnatural for fancy animals to do. Fancy animals go for salubrious climbs, kind of follow material gravity down to the river bottom. Right? They just sort of roll down the hill with material gravity and live along. These peoples are not doing that. Okay. All right, so that's the deal. Right, see, they're establishing civilization because they have that innate potential and that consciousness to make those choices. Okay, and I was just going to bring that up. So we've been here before. Remember, we've got this highlighted region to the south and east of the Caspian Sea with the Kopet Dag, the Kopet Mountains. All right, so again, what that is today, remember, that's the northern border of Iran. You have that mountain range running along there. Just immediately today, on the north side of that, of the Kopet Mountains, is Turkmenistan. And Ashgabat is its capital. It's just immediately on the north side of the Kopet Mountains there. And why is that still a significant place, even though it keeps getting destroyed by earthquakes? The earthquakes are huge. It just flattens everything, and they have to start all over again. But they keep starting over again and over, more than we ever imagined. They've been starting over again there for millennia, right? Because that's in Adamson's neck of the woods. That's sacred land. And they'll build there no matter how many times the earth flattens it, right? And they're reminding you of, when you see this big city there even today, despite, what was it, 1948 or something, I think the last time it was flattened, why is it still there? Why are they carving out, a city there against all odds? It's not as fertile a place as it used to be and stuff. It's just because it goes all the way back to Adamson, right? Why do we hold on to Jerusalem, right? and Machiavelli to Melchizedek. Why do we hold on to this area here around Ashgabat? Because of Adamson. Okay, and
give us much hope for Boulder.
Well, someone just needs to falsely exalt themselves, and Oh, well, that is happening a lot here. So that's again that region. And okay, now see we have the full story. They're choosing to become traders and have urban life. Okay, so that's in that Andite mentality. And we saw them first mentioning this trading there when they're talking about the Tarim Basin. Okay, so if you have a people that have this very definitive idea to have an urban sort of a life and to have commerce, and they established that so definitively in Sin Kang for so long, I'll bet you going into recorded history, there's some definitive sign of a trade route there. What would that trade route be called? The Silk Road. Right? Why is there a Silk Road? The answer is Andites. Right? Right? They established, you know, that networking of the geography for commerce. Right? They set up all this. You know, they explored everywhere. They figured of all the different places you could go, this is the best place. And so that got established thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. You know, and long after everyone has forgotten the existence of Andites, they still walk the same paths. It's like, well, that's just what we've always done. Legacy, tradition, convention. Right? But it's the Andites that first walked those paths and established those well-worn paths. You know, those well-worn locations, those well-worn paths. You know, the Andites are behind all of that. Okay, so we've got the Tarim mummies, we've got the Silk Road, we've got Ashgabat. All right.
Do we have Sinbad?
let's see, what else do we... let's see. I guess we got everything there, didn't we? Notice the commerce in stone metal, right? Remember, we've talked about that. They're going to be the Andites are going to be the engine behind that relatively, you know, it was ages and ages we were in the Paleolithic, right? The old stone age, you know. We went into the Mesolithic like we talked about, and quickly we were in the Neolithic, and you know, relatively quickly we're in the Bronze Age, and relatively quickly we're in the Iron Age. And again, that, you know, going from an arithmetic sort of a process to a geometric one, where the time scales are so much shorter, again, that's the Andites, the engine behind that. Technically, they had metal working way back before the Bronze Age, right? But it... you know, it, with all of this blending with the evolutionary stock and whatnot, you finally don't establish that until like 3500 BC, right? A Bronze Age. But, you know, again, they're behind that drive of civilization. And, you know, obviously they're going to be pushing things out onto the water a lot more than the Sangic peoples did naturally. They're going to have a much greater tendency to build ships and do commerce via the sea, and as you're seeing, they're bringing up at the end there, accelerated on both land and water. See, and it's that accelerated thing that I was just emphasizing, that geometric. And again, it takes some, it takes the, you know, wielding the mind, spirit over mind, in order for things to get accelerated like that. There has to be free will. It can't just be the arithmetic bubbling up matter up into mind. That happens naturally. Okay?
But ever-increasing drought gradually brought about the great Andite exodus from the lands south and east of the Caspian Sea. The tide of migration began to veer from northward to southward, and the Babylonian cavalrymen began to push into Mesopotamia.
See, remember I told you that they would eventually directly say that. Remember how we saw that those early horsemen, those early cavalrymen coming in and assaulting the Mesopotamian peoples, taught them about the horse. And so the final waves, the final three waves out of Mesopotamia was on horseback from 8,000 to 6,000 BC. But, as I pointed out, I mean, eventually they totally take over, and it's not an Andite, Sumerian, whatnot sort of a culture there anymore. It's Babylonia. Once you get to about 2000 BC. Okay, and let's see. They're reminding what I said earlier about Ashgabat. See, the ever-increasing drought gradually brought about the great Andite exodus from the lands south and east of the Caspian Sea. So even if genetically, see, they left the area, we've always built here. There's some reason. I don't know why, but I think we should always build here. There's something important. The people there don't even remember Adamson anymore, like the Andites did. But it's still there, right? There's not nothing there where Adonia, or however you pronounce that, once was. Okay.
Increasing aridity in Central Asia further operated to reduce population and to render these people less warlike. And when the diminishing rainfall to the north forced the nomadic Andonites southward, there was a tremendous exodus of Andites from Turkestan. This is the terminal movement of the so-called Aryans into the Levant and India. It culminated that long dispersal of the mixed descendants of Adam, during which every Asiatic and most of the island peoples of the Pacific were to some extent improved by these superior races.
So in other words, they're just reminding you, you've got a lot of Andonite that was driven down from the, even though they were driven by the Sanguics northward, climate is driving them back down southward. And the Andites are saying, this is getting to be not the greatest land anyway. We'll just let them have it and we'll go further southward. And so the peoples that are in Turkestan today, got a lot of Andonite blended into them. Right? So you can't go to anywhere in Turkestan and say, that's what an Andite looked like. Like I said, if the only way you can do that is to dig up the Turin mummies. Right? And you find something that doesn't look like he's from Turkestan.
And the concentration of Andite, high-quality Andite, that was still pretty intact
by
the in the
terrain. Yeah. Region. Yeah. See, like I pointed out, because it was this very significant outpost. Yeah. It held on the longest in many ways. It's this purest group, and so they hold on by their fingernails longer than those who aren't so pure. You have that. Where there's a will, there's a way phenomenon that, they make it work even though it's becoming almost impossible to live there because it's so dry. If they had a little bit of advanced technology, they'd still be there, right?
Yeah.
and we'd all know of them. Where were we here? We got everything there. I think we did. They mentioned nomadic, Andonites. A lot of peoples are pretty nomadic, and we're seeing the Andites are starting to, they've been pretty nomadic too. We're seeing that settling coming in, and the evolutionary peoples are going to copy the Andites. Oh, we should build a city too, and stay put. I mean, the Andites built cities in the Nile Valley, and long after the Andites don't live in the Nile Valley anymore, they're still living in cities, right? so the Sangic peoples carry on what the Andites teach. Okay?
Thus, while they were dispersed over the Eastern Hemisphere, the Andites were dispossessed of their homelands in Mesopotamia and Turkestan. For it was this extensive southward movement of Andonites that diluted the Andites in Central Asia nearly to the vanishing point.
Yeah, they're telling you what I already said. See, it wasn't a case that totally that the Andites just moved out of the way. There were some that stayed, but you know, then the Andonites blended into them. So that's the people that are there now. You know, it's a much diluted stock there, even if there's vestiges of Andite culture. Okay. Okay, so yeah, and we saw the Babylonian cavalrymen. So we now, you know, both Adam in the second garden and Adamson by the Caspian Sea, they've been dispossessed of the homelands now. See, so that's all in the past now. All the immediate vestiges of Adamson and Adam and Eve. Or I should say Adamson and Rada and Adam and Eve. Okay.
But even in the 20th century after Christ, there are traces of Andite blood among the Turanian and Tibetan peoples, as is witnessed by the blonde types occasionally found in these regions. The early Chinese annals record the presence of the red-haired nomads to the north of the peaceful settlements of the Yellow River, and there still remain paintings which faithfully record the presence of both the blonde Andite and the brunette Mongolian types in the Tarim Basin of long ago.
I told you, at the end there, they're reminding you. See, towards the end, all right, you have both the, you know, by brunette, remember, we mean black hair. Black hair, black-eyed, evolutionary stock, Mongolian types, there with the Andites. So not only are there paintings, but there's graves, right, with mummies in them, you know, or, you know, towards the end, most of them are brunette Mongolian types, you know, with maybe a couple of blonde Andite types thrown in, you know, and of course by blonde Andites, not all blonde, you know, but they're red-haired, brown-haired, or blonde. They're not black-haired and black-eyed. Evolutionary stock. Let's see, and there you see that the red-haired nomads to the north. Like I said, I mean, everyone is initially quite nomadic. But they're choosing to be settled. We've talked about Tehran before. You have Iran and Tehran. And remember, I mentioned before that as you go north of present day Iran, you get a little bit up into Turkmenistan there, and you come upon the Oxus River. You know, that great river that's flowing through there. And so kind of historically, you have sort of the people of greater Iran, everyone to the south and west of the Oxus River up there. And those on the north side, that's Tehran. Yeah. So they're, you know, so in both Tehran and Tibet, you know, we saw before where you had the Andonites in Tibet. You know, so both Tehran and Tibet, you have Andites with a lot of Andonite blended in. Okay. But nonetheless, you're going to see, you know, some residual influence, you know, like they say, like they're saying there, the blonde types, because of all the Andite that was there. Okay. You know, and I, of course, already mentioned the Nazis, you know, noticing, you know, those in Tibet. Okay. Let's see, anything else there? just maybe notice the peaceful settlements of the Yellow River. Remember how naturally Yellow Man kind of just by himself has that tendency. But if you inject a little bit of Andite blood into northern China there, it's going to amp them up a bit. They're not going to be quite so naturally peaceful. They're going to become a little more aggressive. All right. And the final statement here, speaking of residual giddy-up-go from the Andites.
The last great manifestation of the submerged military genius of the Central Asiatic Andites was in AD 1200, when the Mongols under Genghis Khan began the conquest of the greater portion of the Asiatic continent. And like the Andites of old, these warriors proclaimed the existence of, quote, one God in heaven. The early breakup of their empire long delayed cultural intercourse between Occident and Orient and greatly handicapped the growth of the monotheistic concept in Asia.
Okay, so very interesting statements. You know, and of course, the more interesting it gets, the more immediately it's bordering on political incorrectness in the present climate. But just, you know, just how potent is this directionality, you know, and activation from the Andites? It's that potent. Long after there's any Andites, the last ones have been mummified in the in the Taklamakan Desert long ago, 3,000 years, you know, prior. You've got Genghis Khan, you know, who says, you know, I think I should just go to the horizon in every direction. I see. So even there, you might go, well, why Genghis Khan? Why the Mongols, you know, going all the way? Oh, the answer is the Andites.
They weren't Mongols.
Right. No, they weren't Andites.
They were.
But that just totally blended in, so sort of, you know, on the surface, you can't even really tell anymore. It's so blended in, so buried. But still, it's so potent, right? It's a latent Andite potential that found a few individuals that it activated definitively in. But it was just a few individuals, so, you know, it lasted, you know, just a short time, right? I mean, by the end of the 13th century, that was, you know, the Mongols were basically out of gas. But for the whole 13th century, okay, everyone cowered in their villages, you know, as the Mongols were coming over the horizon. You know, and so that gives you a little idea what it was like for the evolutionary peoples, especially when the Andites had horses. Right? As quickly as the Mongols swept all the way over into Eastern Europe, right, and took over China for a while, and everything. I mean, that they swept, you know, into Europe and just took over everything. So again, you know, if you ever wondered why it seems kind of an historical oddity that there would have been that whole Mongol thing. Again, the answer is the Andites, right? Indirectly, but still, the answer is the Andites.
New bumper sticker.
Okay, now notice the interesting stuff that you know they're helping you to understand. Where did that basic sky god idea that the Mongols had? Well, it's the same reason any of the peoples in India or Greece or wherever have a sky god idea. The Andites. You know, why is there a Zeus, you know, and a Roman Jupiter? You know, why is there that sky god or even a sky father? For the Mongols, it's the eternal blue sky. And eternal is obvious. Blue means sky, and sky actually means God. Right? It's the eternal sky God. Right? And it's a monotheistic idea. It's coming from the Sethite priests and the Andites and being spread everywhere. And so even all, obviously they'd lost, they didn't have a very solid hold, but they had the basic potential for monotheism. And if the Mongols had held on to sort of taking a hold of that whole region, it would have fed monotheism into Asia more definitively through them as a conduit. Right? That eternal blue sky thing? That's God the Father. Oh, they would have adopted that easily and fed it into Asia. Right? Right. And the whole bit about why they would have been such an effective conduit, they're taking charge of the whole Silk Road. They're taking charge, and it's very problematic to use those trade routes as the Andites set up, if there's all these raiders and everywhere. But you get someone who just takes a hold of it, like the Romans took a hold of things. And instead of having Pax Romana, you have Pax Mongolia. Right, and then they establish a peace so that you can have trade along routes. And that's what they're pointing out. You think of them as these horrible, heavy-handed people. It's like, well, yes, but think about it in a bigger sense. They would have established a peace through their heavy hand, through which things could have traveled and grown. There's lots of examples in the book about how we have a tendency to, well, that was nothing but evil. No, we're talking about the evolutionary process. Any earnest student of the Urantia book should make a great effort to disabuse themselves of thoughts that, oh, well, I'm absolutely certain that that's right and that's wrong. You are. How are you so certain? Do you understand the fullness of the evolutionary process in the entire universe of universes, where you can absolutely judge that this is a negative end in itself and not actually a means to a greater end? Sure, judged falsely, existentially, out of an evolutionary context, it appears to be bad. But really, there isn't any such thing as an objective bad fact. Right? Evil only exists subjectively in my mind if I choose to put it there. It doesn't exist objectively out there as some black ooze. There isn't anything out there that the Supreme Mind isn't taking towards light and life. Everything is a positive means to a great end. The grand universe settled in light and life. Everything is. There isn't anything that isn't such a means to that great end. Right? Everything is perfectingness. Right? And, or like they say basically up in part four, now, the present moment is a divine dispensation. It's good. Not because it's existentially perfect. There is no such thing in an evolutionary domain. But it's evolutionarily good. It's perfecting. And they're pointing out, right? If you judge the Mongols and Genghis Khan and the Mongols, Kublai Khan and all objectively, right? There's a perfectingness there. Things would have, for those who want progress, if they hadn't fallen apart, there would be a lot more progress now than there is. Right? It appears that he was destroying things. No, he was potentializing things. He was disrupting an old, fractured, non-progressible order and setting up the stage for something to be able to progress. Remember how that's what we ended the previous paper with, that ferments, remember they said? The agitation, right? The disruption of these very unfortunate established calcified orders that humans always want to settle into. You know, and if someone doesn't blow them up, if someone doesn't tear them apart, you know, there can't be progress.
Yeah, they say the same thing about Peter right after Pentecost.
Mm-hmm.
Going off in the wrong direction, supposedly.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's, yeah, so to challenge yourself to stop falsely applying your awareness of the existential to that which isn't. Nothing that you see is existential, right? Matter of fact, there's only one being in all of existence that's purely existential. It's not the second person. It's not the third person. Even those infinite ones are not purely existential. It's the eternal Mother, Son, and the infinite Mother Spirit. There's Mother Deity. There's experiential deity in those two persons. There's only one being, right? The first person that's purely existential, right? And there's only one domain that's purely existential, the Isle of Paradise, which is outside of space and time, right? And so applying existential to any other being or any other thing is inappropriate, okay? And definitely the current arrangement of molecules, you know, in front of you is not eternal. And if, you know, one way or another, it will get changed. Now, the point, of course, is once you allow something to change, there has to be wisdom guiding that change, because change without growth is potential evil. Okay? But change it must. You know, don't. It's like, well, you know, if change without growth is potential evil, maybe we should just not let things change. Maybe we should just really focus on the establishment and the elites who want to rule the establishment, right? You know, and then everything will be okay. There won't be any of that evil stuff because we changed something and it wasn't in conformity with growth. No, it needs to be wisdom, and things must change. You know, climatic change, you know, we're talking about. There isn't any geography on the planet today that won't completely change by the time this world is deeply settled in enlightened life. All mountains will be laid low, right? Everything will change. There aren't any sacred mountains. There aren't any sacred valleys. Sacred plains,
well, you know,
sacred sandbars,
Florida.
It's just, right, it's all going to change one way or another. Okay. Yeah, so anyway.
Personal yep. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you're discerning what you think is evil, for one thing, you might be right about it, and it doesn't mean you're looking at it as an existential thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's an experiential thing also. I mean, we have to try to discern evil, or else we wouldn't be sophistry proof.
Yeah.
For one thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not that you should, you know, put on rose-colored glasses.
Really?
Right? I mean, one needs to face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. And it is a fact that it's very difficult to find anything that's existentially perfect. Yeah, that's a basic fact. But you don't dwell on it. You go, okay, so that's evil. All right. That's really not news. Okay. That's just a simple fact, is that you don't live in Avona, so sure enough, you can find a black spot. But can you see it in more objective terms? Despite the fact that it's a spot that has some issues, some limitations, could you do something productive, positive with it anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, for any one of us, you know, for me, okay, the answer might, okay, with that particular individual, I don't think there's anything I can do productive with that individual. It's just going to go poorly. So the wise thing is for me to not do that. But there's probably someone else who's just the right individual that can actually do something productive with that problematic individual there. Right? So I don't have to rail on them or, you know, or wish them ill. I'll just let them be and find some place where I can do something productive. But knowing full well there's going to be a challenge, I'm not going to find someone who's automatically on the same page as me intellectually, or, you know, about, you know, has the same exact ideas of how to fix a certain problem as I do. We're going to have to go back and forth, and we're going to have to compromise. And I can't demonize them. I can't think about the difference between the two of us existentially. You know, for instance, you don't just marry anyone. You try to marry someone who, where the divide isn't so huge that it's uncrossable. And you try to find someone that you can exercise free will and bridge the gap at least halfway, and they'll do likewise. But obviously, there's all kinds of people that doesn't matter how much you try to use your, you can't bridge that gap. Well, you shouldn't be married to that person. And it doesn't mean that person's bad. They should be married to someone else, or maybe not married at all. Okay? But, it's just, you know, thinking in evolutionary terms and facing the facts as they are and accepting them as they are. You know, it's not that you're accepting them eternally as they are. See, that's what people say. Well, I'm not going to accept it as they are because, no, this is not existential. You're accepting it as it is at this moment in time and at this place in space. And you're going to engage it as it is, where it is, and then there's going to be a super additive consequence between the two of you, and neither you nor or they are going to be the same otherwise, and there's going to be progress. Okay. All right. Okay, what about these? This tendency to conquest that Genghis Khan... Genghis Conquest showed us not that long ago. Look at the title of the next section.
Section 2, The Andite Conquest of India. India is the only locality where all the Urantia races were blended, the Andite invasion adding the last stock. In the highlands northwest of India, the Sangic races came into existence, and without exception, members of each penetrated the subcontinent of India in their early days, leaving behind them the most heterogeneous race mixture ever to exist on Urantia. Ancient India acted as a catch basin for the migrating races. The base of the peninsula was formerly somewhat narrower than now, much of the deltas of the Ganges and Indus being the work of the last 50,000 years.
Okay, so obviously the two big rivers, right, in India, the Ganges in the north and the Indus in the west. So they're going to be points of fixation. And, you know, by base, you know, they mean the northern part of the Indian subcontinent, right? You know, right now when you look, there's a wide extent across northern India there. You know, if you include Bangladesh and Pakistan in that, right? It's a very wide swath. But again, remember, what's pouring out on both sides there. On the west side, the Indus is a great big river pouring out there, you know, depositing huge amounts of sediment. Same way with the Ganges. on the east side. So they're just reminding you that. You go back, you know, 50,000 years ago, and you don't have any of that sediment built up. You know, so it looked very different than it does now. You know, and you don't have all these really lowlands that people, you know, will be inclined to move into and be wiped out, you know, by the hundreds of thousands by big storms and stuff. You know, think Bangladesh, you know. I mean, you got these lowlands, you know, and every time a great big storm came, you know, I mean, oh, 300,000 were killed today, you know. I mean, it was just ridiculous living there in those mud flats of the Ganges. Okay, but anyway, that's what they're reminding you of. You know, we already talked about how much things changed kind of in that Indus Delta region. There used to be a peninsula there where Andan and Fanta lived, and you know, it's radically changed in that area there. Okay, so what do we have here? Let's see. I know there's some other things I wanted to say here. Just that we've talked about the catch basin thing. So anyone that heads east from the Sangik homelands, you know, comes upon, oh, what's this? The land seems to go on forever to the south, you know, and they kind of drift down in there. And so they all kind of get caught in that little catch basin there to some degree. That, you know, any tendency to go east, and of course, before any of them went east, they were intermingling some there in the homeland region. So, like they're saying, you ended up with all of them to some degree blended into the stock there. All right, let's see. Anything else there? I think that pretty much does it. Yeah, go ahead.
The earliest race mixtures in India were a blending of the migrating red and yellow races with the Aboriginal Andanites. This group was later weakened by absorbing the greater portion of the extinct Eastern Green peoples, as well as large numbers of the Orange race, was slightly improved through limited admixture with the Blue Man, but suffered exceedingly through assimilation of large numbers of the Indigo race. But the so-called Aborigines of India are hardly representative of these early people. They are rather the most inferior southern and eastern fringe, which was never fully absorbed by either the early Andites or their later appearing Aryan cousins.
Okay, so, you know, it starts out with a feeling of political incorrectness, definitely there. But notice as they try to remind you, when you're talking about the Sangiks, okay, yeah, you have the primary Sangiks and the secondary Sangiks, and so in that sense, you have a superior and an inferior. But, you know, don't think hardly human when you think inferior in that primary-secondary contrast. The problem is there's so many of, you know, each of the Sangiks has a spectrum, a bell curve of genetic quality. And there's so many backwaters areas on the planet that accumulated the lesser tail, especially of the secondary Sangiks, that you have some just very minimal genetics in a lot of areas to a high degree. I mean, you know, think Calcutta, someone named Mother Teresa finding issues there. Okay? You know, what did they just, you know, say there? The inferior southern and eastern fringe. Yeah. You know, but it is still the case that even though we can't really get a sense of just how noble pure Sangiks were, even as pure Sangiks, primary Sangiks lean into life a little bit more than secondary Sangiks, right? That all six of them are relative to violet race are place-like, but the secondary Sangiks are very place-like. They don't lean into life much at all. You know, they tend to be very in the moment, and tend to be very localized. You know, they were especially the indigo were the last to go from the homeland. See, they had the least directional sense, right, to move from where they were born. You know, so isn't that funny? I mean, you know, so you end up with Africa with so much indigo stock, you know, and the indigos are the last to move from the homeland. And so they're the last into Africa, and we think that Africa is where everything came from. We're just, you know, so in a sense, we have everything completely 180 degrees flipped. You know, instead of everything out of Africa, it's, you know, it's last into Africa. All right, let's see, what else there? Remember how we saw before that the greater portion of the extinct Eastern Green peoples, that Green Man didn't just go to the West, you know, and into Northern Africa. You had a significant number of them that went east into India. And so, like we said before, that's why even today you find someone in the Indian subcontinent that is quite black-skinned, because you can see they've got all three secondary sanguics, the orange and the green and the indigo. So they can be very black-skinned, but in bright sunlight, the fact that there's a lot of green comes out in some of them, and you can get a distinctly green-skinned individual there in India, because there's such a, you know, it wasn't sort of a, and by the way, some of that Sangic group went to India. No, a lot of the green man went to India, okay, unlike orange man, say. Okay, anything else there? I think we got everything there. Yep, okay, go ahead.
By 20,000 BC, the population of Western India had already become tinged with the Adamic blood. And never in the history of Urantia did any one people combine so many different races. But it was unfortunate that the secondary Sangic strains predominated. And it was a real calamity that both the blue and the red man were so largely missing from this racial melting pot of long ago. More of the primary Sangic strains would have contributed very much toward the enhancement of what might have been an even greater civilization. As it developed, the red man was destroying himself in the Americas, the blue man was disporting himself in Europe, and the early descendants of Adam, and most of the later ones, exhibited little desire to admix with the darker colored peoples, whether in India, Africa, or elsewhere.
Right, so just, you know, the basic natural tendency, right? There's not going to be as much of a tendency for the Andites to mate with the secondary Sangics as with the primary Sangics. You know, it's subtle things like, you know, like I've often commented, you know, you have this notion that couples that have been married for decades and decades, you know, supposedly start to look like each other. It's like, no. Look at the engagement announcements in the newspaper. They look like each other to begin with. That's why they look like each other when they've been married for 40 or 50 years. Right, we have a natural tendency to be attracted to someone that looks like us. And we don't even notice that. You know, it's like, but, you know, it's the same kind of basic chin shape or nose shape or cheeks or whatever. We pick up on that subtly and go, I don't know why I think you're so beautiful, but you are. It's like, well, it's because you're looking in the mirror, right? so that's, you know, that's just a natural thing. So, there's a little bit more morphological similarity between the Andites and the primary Sangics. You know, so you had more mating there than with the secondary Sangics. You know, in other words, with what we call Mongoloid peoples in contrast to Negroid peoples. Yeah, so that's just natural. And then, you know, I love this one, the funniest sentences. So you've got the, red man, of course, you know, he has such a tendency to kill each other from tribe to tribe, you know, so destroying himself in the Americas. And then blue man was disporting himself in Europe. That's my favorite one. You know, in other words, he's amusing himself. He's playing with himself, you know, basically, in Europe. Yeah, so, you know, be humble about your perhaps navel-gazing tendencies there from the blue man in your background. You know, you can see that it would be very handy for blue man to get some andite uplift to get him focused towards the horizon a little bit more if he's having a tendency to just kind of be going in circles within himself. Okay. And coincidentally, where did most of the andites go? They went to Europe. It looks like the blue man needed it. You know, so it's kind of interesting. They seemed to need it most, but they were kind of the most immediately sexually attractive to the andites. So it goes hand in hand. Let's see, anything else there? Yeah, that's right, about at the beginning there. So by way back, by 20,000 BC, you have it in Western India. Guys, remember, that's current Pakistan, the Indus Valley. So, and that's just a hop, skip, and a jump, obviously, from Mesopotamia. So that's not surprising that even very early on, you'd have, before they have andites, you'd have a trickle of Adamites going over into the Indus Valley region there. So even way, way, way before the quote-unquote Indus Valley civilization, you know, the Bronze Age civilization, you were already seeding it there in the Indus Valley region. It's going to be a draw down the road because of that. Okay, what else do they say here?
About 15,000 BC, increasing population pressure throughout Turkestan and Iran occasioned the first really extensive Andite movement toward India. For over 15 centuries, these superior peoples poured in through the highlands of Baluchistan, spreading out over the valleys of the Indus and Ganges, and slowly moving southward into the Deccan. This Andite pressure from the northwest drove many of the southern and eastern inferiors into Burma and southern China, but not sufficiently to save the invaders from racial obliteration.
Okay, so let me start with that last part there, because we're kind of already talking about that. And they'll detail this in greater, you know, coming up here. But you're pushing them into Burma, you know, immediately to the east of India, and into southern China. So one of the reasons that you ended up with a lot of the shorter stature stock in Southeast Asia is not merely because the secondary Sangiks had a tendency, like especially Indigo Man, to migrate along the shore on the most southern and end up kind of in a Southeast Asia catch basin. That tendency was fostered by the Andites actually shoving them that direction. And unfortunately, it's some of the lesser. So, you know, it's going to lead to an even greater differential in China, for instance. And you have the Andites penetrating, at least as a civilizational influence, if not genetically, into northern China. And you have some of the least of the Sangic genetics being shoved into southern China. And no wonder you have such a definitive civilization in the north phenomenon in China. And again, you see kind of the answer to that is the Andites. And again, see, the Andites are just, you know, they're setting up the stage the way we find it today. Okay, so if you're not familiar with that term, the Deccan Plateau, I mean, that's the main triangular southern, you know, bulk of the Indian subcontinent. Between the mountain ranges on the east and the west, you have that whole central region, the Deccan. Okay. But obviously, the Andites, you know, they can't just go south and drive all of the Sangiks completely out and take over the Deccan, because there's nowhere to drive them, right? There's mountains and then there's ocean, you know, on both sides. So this is obviously going to have issues. They're going to get stopped, and over time they're just going to get absorbed and blended in, and you'll hardly know that the Andites were there when all is said and done. And that's, we won't get to that tonight, but that's you know, getting into the next section. Let's see. But when they start out there about 15,000 BC, so does everyone remember what's the significance there compared to, say, 20,000 BC? No, we're way past it. Remember, it's going at 15,000 BC, you basically are going now to Andite instead of Adamite. Yeah, the 15,000 BC is really when the Andite phenomenon is in play instead of Adamite. Okay.
So, question.
Yep.
So, if these guys, you know, are so superior, so to speak, how mm-hmm. come they get so, you know, amalgamated? I mean, how come they end up disappearing and the other guys don't?
It's
that numbers are so much greater.
Yeah, it's just an issue of numbers. And the fact that the life carriers designed this with a vast conspiracy, where given enough time, you know, I think I am going to mate with that. I mean, given enough time, we mate. And so it, in the end, it's a numbers game, you know. And that's why the revelators say, you know, it's still a numbers game. You can't just start, you know, intermating willy-nilly on the planet. There's way... The racial stocks are way inappropriate for that. This tiny little bit of Adamic blood will be totally diluted in such a vast reservoir of Sangik that you can't. That little bit of Andite can't uplift that much Sangik. You know, if Adam and Eve had been guiding it, they wouldn't have allowed such an extensive overpopulation of Sangik to set in before everything was blended together and upstepped. Right? The whole point is for things to get blended together and upstepped when you don't need, you know, billions of Adamites to do it. You know? But now it's gone all these millennia, you know, and you know it's basically beyond the realm, you know, even if you imagined doing what's not going to happen, of having an Adam and Eve come again and start the process all up again. There's just way too many Sangiks. The only way you can fix this is through a long process of genetic engineering. You just, you know, it's too big of an ocean to put a drop of water, put a drop of gerasim into anymore. You know, and of course we've talked about, you know, don't be surprised if there aren't things that happen where a lot of people, you know, die off for various reasons too. But nonetheless, yeah. Okay, so let's see, what else we have here? Just that they're, notice that you've got them coming into the southern route there through Baluchistan. Because like I was saying, I mean, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to go from Mesopotamia if you just kind of go, you know, if you don't go up and back down again, right? If you just go straight east to get to the Indus Valley there. So, all right. Okay, let's keep going here.
The failure of India to achieve the hegemony of Eurasia was largely a matter of topography. Population pressure from the north only crowded the majority of the people southward into the decreasing territory of the Deccan, surrounded on all sides by the sea. Had there been adjacent lands for emigration, then would the inferiors have been crowded out in all directions, and the superior stocks would have achieved a higher civilization.
All right, so you would have gotten a significant amount of Andite in there relative to the residual Sangic that wouldn't have been driven out, you know, and maybe not driven out just because they would have been, they wouldn't have been such, you know, sort of the lesser in the bell curve, and they would have been blended in. You know, the Andites would have mated with, you know, the better Sangic peoples. And so, as they're pointing out, you could have had basically all of, you could have had a little mini what Adam and Eve would have done. You could have had a little bit of each of the Sangic races and the Andonites blended together and upstepped with an adequate amount of Adamic blood in that little location, and you would have had the leadership of the world, right? The hegemony of Eurasia. You would have had the kind of, you know, you would have had all of that Sangic potential actualized by that Adamic uplift in a very balanced way. And they just would have inescapably become the leaders of all of Eurasia. No one could have matched them in symmetry of mind. Right? They would have been a glorious people. They would have been, you know, the people that Adam and Eve were supposed to see to the production of, right? The evolution of. But geography messed it up. Right? So, you know, what might have been? If rebellion and default don't complicate things, geography does. Okay?
And they weren't the kind of people who were just
going to
wipe them out.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, they would have definitely blended in with, I mean, remember, because the Andites have a long tradition that's what they're supposed to do, is go out and uplift.
So if the Bering Straits hadn't been up, the same thing may have happened up in the yellow race
Moved to
the red.
Yeah. So geography, you know, it ends up playing a very interesting role in the Supremes process here. You know, who gets blended when and how. And because you don't have Adam and Eve unnaturally managing it like they would have, it all is just going to play out through the evolutionary process. You have curious pathways, right? When it does that, when that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution achieves, it sometimes takes very curious paths. Okay, let's see. What else we have there? Yeah, I guess we got everything there, didn't we? Yep, let's get a little bit more here.
As it was, these earlier Andite conquerors made a desperate attempt to preserve their identity and stem the tide of racial engulfment by the establishment of rigid restrictions regarding intermarriage. Nonetheless, the Andites had become submerged by 10,000 BC, but the whole mass of the people had been markedly improved by this absorption.
Okay, so and you know, later on, you know, they keep trying this. You know, it's like, well, let's set up a definitive caste system, and right, I mean, they tried mightily to not just, you know, have everyone treating it as a six of one half of a dozen of another issue, and just blend together. But it's, you know, the life carriers have a very aggressive design that they put into us. We will mate. So by 10,000 BC, now it's all been melted in. In this case, unlike with South America, with that handful of Andites that went across the Pacific, where basically there wasn't enough genetics there to really have a biologic impact, so it was just a cultural impact, and the Sangic's copying what the Andites taught them. Here, yeah, okay, the Sangics are going to copy what the Andites taught them, but this is a lot of Andites that went in there. So you, it's not a lot of uplift, but it's a little bit. Let's see here. Anything else there? Oh, just see, they made a desperate attempt. Like I said, I mean, the life carriers have a very definitive design. They can see that no matter how much they try to set up taboos and whatnot, you know, hormones are powerful things. Okay. All right, let's keep going.
Race mixture is always advantageous in that it favors versatility of culture and makes for a progressive civilization. But if the inferior elements of racial stocks predominate, such achievements will be short-lived. A polyglot culture can be preserved only if the superior stocks reproduce themselves in a safe margin over the inferior. Unrestrained multiplication of inferiors with decreasing reproduction of superiors is unfailingly suicidal of cultural civilization.
Oh, I see why they put a large paragraph break here. This is where the politically incorrect stuff begins. Oh, okay.
That's exactly what's happening.
Yes.
We're in big trouble.
Yeah, see.
I'm freaking out over it. I don't know what to do.
Right, and just, it should be very obvious to you that they're suddenly not talking about the Indus Valley region thousands of years ago. They're talking about the United States right now.
Europe, more so right now.
Right.
It's a nightmare.
But again, the book, you know, right? The leading edge of Andite civilization left Europe and moved to the United States. That's the whole point. Right, so, yeah, it just, you know, we all know how this is working. Which peoples have this notion in their head that, you know, overpopulation, it's a really huge problem. I think I need to stop procreating. Which peoples are doing that?
The ones that
still have a tiny little bit of Andite mentality, right, that want, actually are a people oriented towards the future so that this planet has a future potential, as opposed to those that are very place-like and kind of just live in the moment, don't really see themselves a people of the future. Those people don't have that notion that overpopulation is some future problem. No, they're breeding like rabbits.
22 kids.
Right. All right. And no matter how politically that is incorrect, that is to say, that's the fact. That's the genetic fact. And that is why this book is in my lap, again, right? Unfailingly suicidal to cultural civilization. There is a civilizational emergency. It exists for many reasons, but foundationally it exists because of genetics. I mean, everything is foundationally because of genetics. You have to face the fact of genetics and adjust to ideals, and in order to proceed wisely as a civilization, at least those that, even if they don't have a lot of Andite blood, they at least have an Andite mentality about civilization. Those peoples can't stop procreating.
But they have.
Exactly. And so, yeah, well, there's always the big reset button of the interregnum. Okay. Yep, June.
Well, it's very clear that the solution is not a natural one.
Yes.
The solution has to be a very artificial solution.
Yes, and that was the point I was just going to make. Remember how we emphasized the only reason that there's urban life and commerce and stuff is because of that unnatural consciousness that the Andite can muster? Okay, that needs to happen again, very definitively. Because those with a little bit of spiritual consciousness naturally are unfortunately over conscientious and think they shouldn't procreate. That's what happens naturally to someone with a little bit of spiritual consciousness. Right? That, those people with that little bit of spiritual consciousness need to do something unnatural now, soon. Like not think that somehow their whole culture should be predicated on the future fear of overpopulation. Overpopulation is not a problem. If there gets to be too many people, they die, and it's not a problem anymore. There is no such problem, okay? You know, and that sounds harsh, but it's like, but remember, everyone dies. Are we thinking that everyone is not going to die? No, everyone dies. That's part of the process. Death is a technique of the of God. For instance, it's a technique for solving overpopulation, and God set it up. I mean, if you're that foolish that you, you know, put 100 million people in 5 square inches, okay, then you're going to die. Don't do that. But don't stop procreating. Okay? Because of some future fear. Right? Any potential overpopulation is a trivial problem compared to no more Adamic civilization. If you want something to fear for the future, don't fear overpopulation. Fear no civilization. Have the kind of fear that you have back in the first developmental epoch, the nutrition epoch, right? Where you're pretty sure you're not going to live today because you can't find any food, right? Now, there's something to have an animal fear about. But an abstraction like overpopulation, bringing an end to civilization, is ridiculous. Okay, but that's what's happening.
I'm not so sure that was motivated by worries about population. I think that was just selfish. I don't want more than 2 kids. It's too much headache.
And economics.
Right, 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 yeah.
And economics.
Yeah.
But remember, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of additional things that have gotten blended into this. Why I'm not going to have kids, right? I mean, you know, the book points out a number of them. I'm not bringing up all of them, but it got seriously started in Western culture, you know, by the fact that, you know, you have enough of a future time orientation that you can be your own worst enemy. You know, you project population forward in the future. You go, oh my goodness, if it keeps on growing like this, everyone's going to die of starvation. Okay, the people that don't have a future prime orientation, so they don't project forward like that, don't have that fear. And they just happily procreate. Right? Or maybe I should merrily. Merrily procreate. Okay?
To Riggio's point, a lot of people who are thinking and reflecting and considering before they have kids and take the time to do that, think, oh my, you know, I want my children to have the ability to do this, that, and the other thing. I want to be financially solid before I start having kids. And they start thinking about these things with the future orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in addition to overpopulation, I think that these, you know, there are a lot of things that people are thinking about it, and it gets thought about a lot more.
Yes.
Other than I'm at the age where I am able to have kids, so I'm going to get started,
mm-hmm.
which some people do, and they don't really consider, well, what happens next?
Right. How am I going to feed these kids? How am I going to have a place for them to sleep? Yeah. Right. They don't think about those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see how difficult it is. When you get a little bit more of a spiritualized people, right, they have thoughts that they aren't processing well. It's not that we shouldn't have those thoughts. We shouldn't go backwards. We just need to start dealing with those future projections and stuff better. Because, you know, you say, okay, we're not going to have kids yet because, well, let's both get settled jobs first. Okay, well, let's not quite have kids yet because we need to get a definitive house first. Okay, well, let's not quite have... Oh, we can't have kids anymore. I'm too old now. Whoops. All right, you know how this works, and it's working that way more and more. You know, not to mention, you know, as it starts to get enculturated more, I mean, people don't even think in terms of children anymore in a lot of sectors, like you're pointing out. It's just, it's becoming a non-thought in some sectors, okay? You know, that's like if we had all followed Paul's advice religiously and not married and not had kids. Would there be Christianity today? No, that would have ended very quickly. Right? I mean, again, the life carriers designed us to aggressively just procreate without thinking about it a lot. But once you become spiritualized enough, you actually can have enough free will that you can overrule that instinct. Right, we've been talking about how the Andites didn't make it because, well, those life carriers, their design is pretty potent. That's not, see, we're finally to the point now, especially since like the middle of the 20th century, where we're spiritual enough because of the sixth adjutant dawning in the collective, not to mention what Michael did 2,000 years ago, that we can actually bring in enough free will to overrule the maternal instinct, overrule our sex drive. You know, so
you take birth control, so you don't overrule
yourself. Yeah, well, but you're still right. You're effectively overruling it, right?
Not the sex drive.
Yeah, but you get what I mean,
yeah.
Right? So we need to think about the bigger picture. You know, what would have happened if those Andites, you know, or those Adamites in Mesopotamia had stopped procreating? Right? We would all be scraping around in the dirt with a stick, you know, looking for grubs or something. Right? So,
Chris,
yeah.
The problem is, though, is that what we just read is what is happening, and it's too late. People didn't procreate, and countries are being overrun. And I don't understand what could possibly get us out of it.
Yeah, again, we'll have to see. I mean, if it was genuinely hopeless, the revelators wouldn't have given us this.
I know, somehow, but it's like it's right now.
Yeah,
it's already too late.
I know. It's going to be very difficult.
Yeah. I do have to calm down about it. It's like the one issue that I can't let go of.
Yeah. But it's just, you know, we it's not that we don't love every human.
I know, it's not, definitely.
Right.
Not
but we have to separate the spiritual from the material. We can't blur them together. Just because you love the person doesn't mean you should mate with them. Right? Well, it's like, well, I thought that's what love meant. No. Love is on the sixth level of meaning. That mating thing you're calling love, that's on the level of the flesh. That's on the first level of meaning. Right?
But you said the life carriers made it so we will mate. But
yeah.
In this situation, that is such a catastrophe in my view.
Yeah.
We shouldn't mate.
Yeah. Yeah. Really if you have enough free will potential to impose not procreating on yourself, like, well, okay, use that kind of energy to very definitively select who you should mate with.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Right? Don't just be driven by, well, that's the other sex. That's the only pre-requirement. You know, don't be so indiscriminate about it.
Speaking from experience, you know, you can mate even with other races from a point of idealism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, your idealism can transcend
yes.
these racial, you know,
Yeah. Yeah, you mean obviously I hadn't brought done that little follow-up. Remember early on they pointed out how there wasn't a natural attraction. Well, you get spiritual enough and you have this false idealism, this material idealism, and you overrule and you mate in a way that, is not as natural as you would unwittingly. Yep. All right, so all that, see, it's very problematic to have a little bit of spiritual consciousness, but haven't taken enough delight in cultivating to having the insight and the wisdom to properly manage that spiritualization. Okay, the final little paragraph here.
Had the Andite conquerors been in numbers three times what they were, or had they driven out or destroyed the least desirable third of the mixed orange green indigo inhabitants, then would India have become one of the world's leading centers of cultural civilization, and undoubtedly would have attracted more of the later waves of Mesopotamians that flowed into Turkestan and thence northward to Europe.
Yeah, so again, just what a great civilization could have been there, see? And it's just a numbers thing, right? Either if more had gone that way instead of into Europe, it wouldn't have been a huge amount more, see, like they said. Or if they had just been more what we would call ruthless about exterminating the baser orders of humanity, like like how this paper started out. What did Badanin and his crew do? They exterminated all the baser orders, right? We have a very difficult time thinking like that now, okay? So that's probably not the route we're going to take. But we got to do something. We've got to, at least don't, think indiscriminately about mating. But anyway, isn't it interesting that you see kind of the same kind of wording here about what might have been in India, the way they talk about what might have been if the life carrier plan for having the first generation of Adam and Eve's children mate with the biologic offspring of the prince's staff, and remember how they talked about that what might have been in terms of a philosophic leadership. See, they brought in the same thing here, hegemony, leadership. What kind of a leadership people there would have been for the whole world that would have come out of India. But it didn't happen.
They say the same thing about, if Christianity had gone east, mm-hmm. It didn't happen. What would have happened in India? What would have happened in China? As you said before, these are all these speculations, but that's not what happened.
Yeah, there's just.
So you got to deal with what did happen.
Right, yeah. Could have, should have, would have. Right. So, like I said, obviously the evolutionary process is going to play out in a very interesting, curious way on this planet. A number of kind of, that would have been a great solution there. Why didn't that happen? Why didn't they move heaven and earth so that happened? Right? Obviously, the planetary administrators could have done something to make it happen, but they didn't. They trust in the long-term plan.
It does say they have some plan, don't they? Melchizedek.
We have to keep... remember, even the primary supern of him, is kind of saying that, okay, now I know there is some plan here.
Not saying so. The geography is what caused all the races to be there.
Yeah.
If the geography were different,
this potential that they see
never developed would have never existed. So.
Yeah. See, isn't it interesting? It set up the potential, but also short-circuited it. So, the geographic issue. So anyway. That wasn't the way this planet is going to go forward. It's going to be a different path. You can see that in so many ways, it makes sense that Michael comes here and does a very, very oddball thing. Because everything about this world, it's like, well, that kind of would have been the natural way for things to go. No, it didn't go that way. Well, this is obviously going to be the exception to all exceptions, this world, right? The way it's finally going to get to light in life is going to be a way that probably has never happened before. A very curious path. Okay, so next time we'll go back to a little less politically incorrect material. And what about setting the stage, you know, in India for those subsequent so-called Aryan, you know, Andites that come in? And that's where we'll start next time. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.